Case number 077126, Betty B. Murchison, individually and as personal representative of the estate of John P. Murchison, Jr., deceased, appellant, versus Intercity Mortgage Corporation Profit Sharing and Pension Plans et al. Mr. Tirana for appellant, Mr. Wilkins for amicus curiae.
May it please the court, Bardiel Tirana, attorney for appellant Betty Murchison. I'd like to begin with the letter which was sent to the court last night by the amicus curiae on the issue of jurisdiction. I was provided the letter by Mr. Wilkins and copies of the material, so I've had time fully to be acquainted with the issue. The court's jurisdiction arises from several different matters. The judgment filed March 2, 2006 in appeal number 04-7137 at appendix 363 established finality of the district court's final order filed August 24, 2004, Appendix 343, as the law of the case. This court's judgment in the 2004 appeal implicitly treated the pendant jurisdiction judgment for an accounting as to the Murchison Brothers partnership as a collateral issue, not defeating appellate jurisdiction on the remainder of the issues in that appeal.
When you say implicit.
Yes.
The Supreme Court has this very colorful language that says drive-by decisions about jurisdiction are not precedential. So implicit sounds like a drive-by, that is one where the court doesn't say we have jurisdiction, just assumes we have jurisdiction. Are we talking about a drive-by determination here?
I really don't know, Your Honor, because I can't read anything other than the text of this court's judgment.
But there's nothing in the judgment that indicates more than drive-by.
Well, there is a lot in the judgment. The reason that this court, declined to rule on the subject of the accounting of the Murchison Brothers partnership, for which judgment had been entered in 2001, was that I'd made a motion in the district court to compel the defendant, George Murchison, to do what the judgment required, and the district court had not acted on the motion to compel. But you can look at the Murchison Brothers partnership issue as a collateral issue. And you can also look at it.
You're not invoking Cohen versus Beneficial Loan, are you?
I'm sorry?
You weren't invoking Cohen versus Beneficial Loan, are you?
I'm not sure. I'm relying on the court's decision.
Well, that's the origin of the collateral order appealability doctrine.
What do you mean when you say it's collateral?
It was collateral to the fundamental issue of the ERISA case. And the court, I don't know why the court did what it did. I thought the court should have ruled on the Murchison Brothers partnership. It chose not to, and said that portion of its decision, this court said that portion of its decision was not final. But if you look at what the district court had done, it had ordered the defendant to do certain things equivalent to an accounting. It ordered an accounting. It didn't require anything further to be done other than the filing of accounts and receipts, which wasn't done. Now, when the district court ordered an accounting, it ordered the defendant to do acts. Those acts were in the nature of an injunction. It was injunctive relief, although framed in the language of an accounting, equitable relief. Now,
you don't just want an accounting in the sense of somebody saying this is how much is owed. You want an accounting in the sense of this is how much is owed and payment made to you, right?
Absolutely.
And that part, even if the court ordered the accounting, the court did not order or even resolve the question of what you're finally owed, correct?
Yeah. My problem, and one of the reasons I'm here, is that the district court in its 2007 final order, which this court treated as a final order.
Treated, you mean in our July 11th, 2007?
Order.
Denial of petition for mandamus?
Yes.
So, but that's one saying it appearing that the district court has issued a final judgment. Is that what you mean?
Yes. This.
We don't usually just, if we think it's a final judgment, we say so. Here we just said it appears to be a final judgment.
It appears. That is correct, Your Honor.
That ground denied mandamus. Of course, there might be other grounds to deny mandamus.
To be sure. But one thing that is clear, the first order for an accounting, the first judgment for an accounting was entered in 2001. Appeals were taken from that judgment by Betty as a cautionary measure. By George, his appeal was dismissed for want of prosecution. There was a final order in 2004, which wasn't final. Appeals were taken from that, and this court acted on those appeals as if it had jurisdiction.
Well, the opposing counsel apparently didn't tell us the night before that we actually didn't have jurisdiction. I mean, that in those cases, sometimes the court is able to recognize the lack of jurisdiction, and sometimes it has to rely on counsel to warn it that it doesn't have jurisdiction. It doesn't resolve the question that if nobody was arguing no jurisdiction and the court therefore didn't realize it on its own, that doesn't resolve the question.
I would think, Your Honor, we get to law of the case. And law of the case at the appellate level, because
my recollection is that there are cases saying that law of the case doesn't apply to something that is simply assumed by the prior court.
I don't have authority on that, Your Honor. This is a little bit of an unusual case, but I think when this court remanded, if it had jurisdiction in the 2004 appeal, it has not lost jurisdiction. It remanded for things to be done.
Well, we did lose jurisdiction once we remanded. The question is now whether we have interlocutory jurisdiction again or whether we have jurisdiction over a final order. We certainly don't have continuing jurisdiction once we remand.
No, but having issued a judgment and the case having gone back to the district court, this court's judgment in 2004 doesn't disappear. And when the case comes back to this court, you don't have to argue. I don't think... that this court must ignore or can ignore what transpired in the 2004 appeal.
Just tell me again, what is it that transpired in that appeal that makes this judgment final? What aspect of our decision in... You're talking about 2006, right?
2006. It's the 2004 appeal.
Yes.
This court's judgment was 2006.
Right. What part of that of our judgment there makes this judgment final?
The decision as to the Central Avenue joint venture basically wrapped up all of the issues on the Central Avenue joint venture. What was not wrapped up was the Murchison Brothers partnership. And what remained to be done with the Murchison Brothers partnership was for the district court to make a final decision on the motion to compel. The district court did that in another way. It reissued an order compelling an accounting.
Right, so before the court had not compelled an accounting, correct?
No, it ordered an accounting in 2001, mm-hmm. made it a final a judgment for an accounting of the Murchison Brothers Partnership in 2001, entered a final order which made the judgment, the 2001 judgment, a final judgment. This court ruled in its 2006 judgment that it wasn't a final judgment as to the Murchison Brothers partnership because there was an outstanding motion to compel. The outstanding motion to compel is resolved and has been resolved by the final judgment of the district court in 2007. So what we have now...
I'm sorry to ask you to do this. If you could look at the judgment, which is at 364, 363, 365, just tell me what paragraph you're referring to.
You go to the... beg your pardon, Your Honor. It is the paragraph beginning, "We have no jurisdiction," at 364. That's on the Murchison Brothers partnership.
Right. We have no jurisdiction to order the district court to grant her motion to hold George in contempt. That's what was said there, right?
Right.
That's on a contempt motion.
Right. It's saying no jurisdiction. The district court has yet to rule on the motion, and there is no final order for us to review.
So do you think that stands for the proposition that from now on, when there's no final order, we have jurisdiction over it, all non-final orders?
I mean, no.
Is that what you're saying?
No, I'm just saying that
you're
in this
case... The rest was final.
The rest was final.
But there wasn't an order for an accounting before. The order for the accounting that we're talking about now, maybe I misunderstood, I thought is the order that we directed the court to address whether there should be an accounting, right?
No. This court, in its 2006 judgment,
yes,
did not enter any order for relief on the Murchison Brothers partnership because there was a pending motion to hold George in contempt. And that's the paragraph by which this court carved out the Murchison Brothers partnership from a complete disposition of the appeal.
I see.
When this court did that, it was looking at a judgment ordering an accounting entered in 2001. And that appears at... Appendix 312. That judgment was made final in 2004. And looking at 312, it's the first decretal paragraph at the top of the of Appendix 312, page 3 of the order.
And was the appeal filed before or after these various requirements of the account were made?
There are three appeals. There was a 2001 appeal, which Betty filed for protective purposes, which was dismissed with more or less Betty's acknowledgement that it was premature. There was an appeal by George Murchison, which was dismissed for lack of prosecution. That's appeal number two. Then there was a final order appearing at 343 of the appendix, entered 2004, making the judgment for an accounting in the Murchison Brothers partnership final.
Meaning that the court wasn't going to do anything. Is that right?
It meant...
Meaning that the court was satisfied with whatever the accounting was, and that was the end as far as it was concerned.
I don't think one can read into anything in the final order as to the court's intention other than to make it a final order and end the case. So the court made it a final order and ended the case. And
well, I understand that, but I guess maybe you can talk me through this. On the paragraph that you were telling me about on page 364, which is our prior opinion, we said, with respect to the joint venture, the district court never explained why Betty was not entitled to the accounting information she requested.
Right.
So we're obviously, it seems to me, we were reading the district court as denying her the right to that accounting.
That I think the issue you and I are having, Your Honor, is that the previous paragraph, we have no jurisdiction, relates to the order for a final accounting as to the Murchison Brothers partnership.
Yes.
And that there, Betty was granted the relief she was seeking at the in the 2001 order at Appendix 312. The joint venture is a Central Avenue joint venture, a different partner, a different entity.
I understand. That's the second paragraph. That's the one that starts with respect to the joint venture.
Yeah.
So I guess what I'm trying to understand is the motion, the district court's motion, the motion that was filed in the district court to hold George in contempt, was that contempt for failing to comply with the court's final order? Or was that something else?
It was a motion for contempt because of George's failure to do what was required in the decretal paragraph at Appendix 312.
Right. So that there are different ways to conceptualize this, and this may be one of the more confusing cases that we've had before us with respect to exactly what happened. But you can... The court can order something, issue a final judgment, and then after there is a final judgment, if the party doesn't comply, then the other party comes in and says, well, they are in contempt of the court's final judgment order and ask for contempt. That doesn't render the original final judgment not final. It just starts a new process trying to get compliance with the final judgment, right?
Yes.
And is that not... what happened with respect to this paragraph that says we have no jurisdiction? That is, there was a final order. The case ended. Then some years later, you came in and asked that the person be held in contempt because they hadn't complied with the final order. Is that a correct or incorrect characterization?
That's absolutely correct. And there was a slight procedural difficulty. There had not been a final judgment in 2001. I filed the motion for contempt before the order for a final judgment had been entered.
Before the 2004?
Before the 2004. I filed the motion for contempt in 2002. And... I think the jurisdictional issue raised in the letter to the court yesterday evening is that for accountings generally, something more needs to be done than simply to say, thou shalt account. And typically, a court supervises what is done. So the cases cited by the amicus curiae correctly point out that in the normal case, following an order as to liability to account, which is equitable in nature, things happen, and they happen under the aegis of the court, and the court figures out what do you have to pay and who do you have to pay it to. That didn't happen. When the district court entered its final order in 2004, it seemed to indicate that the case was at an end and it wasn't going to do anything
more.
Your
point is that although you asked for more than just a piece of paper saying these are the accounts, the court decided, no, I'm not going to give you any more. This is all I'm going to give you, and that's the end. And for that reason, unlike an accounting which would normally end in something else, this is a final judgment because, in your view, the court has wrongly ended it just with the order on an accounting.
Thank you, Your Honor. I wish I could have been so articulate.
Excuse me. I guess I thought one of the things on which you sought relief was to ask us to get the district court to move forward on the accounting. Not that the accounting had been dropped, but that it was languishing and George was failing to do anything. Have I completely got that wrong?
Well, I don't. You know, we're back at the same position now in appeal number 4, because this court reversed on the denial of an accounting for the Central Avenue joint venture, and specifically told the district court how it should go about providing for an accounting in a simple, straightforward, and quick way. And that appears at page 364 of this court's judgment. It's the two paragraphs beginning with respect to the joint venture. And then...
I'm with you there. I'm with you up to that point.
And next, we go back to the district court on remand by this court. And what the district court did after it filed a petition for mandamus and this court ordered the district court to respond, the district court entered a final order repeating, and the final order appears at 379 to 381. It repeats the requirement, first a part of a judgment in 2001, nearly 8 years ago, that George provide an accounting for the Murchison Brothers partnership. And that appears in the second decretal paragraph at Appendix 380. Now, this had already been ordered in 2001, made a part of the final judgment in 2004, and made a part of the and a new identical judgment entered in 2007, but no enforcement, none of the steps leading to payment of money have occurred, and the district court has indicated, seems to have indicated, by its term heading final order, that it wasn't going to do anything more. Also, in 2007, at the first decretal paragraph on appendix page 379, district court, orders an accounting on the Central Avenue joint venture. The district court does not do what this court required it to do. In the last full paragraph at appendix page 364. Again, the district court in 2007 seems to be indicating that it isn't going to do anything more. It's finished with the case. Now, I filed some motions. I filed a lot of motions. But nothing comes back.
Okay, thank you very much for your argument. I'll hear from Amicus.
May it please the court. My name is Scott Wilkins, and I'm appearing as amicus curiae, appointed by this court on appeal to represent arguments in favor of the position of George Murchison. And I will first address the issue of jurisdiction, since that was what the court seems to be most interested in at this point. The critical issue here is that the current order on appeal involves two different accountings. One of which was ordered back in 2001, but one of which was only ordered in 2007 in the most recent district court order on appeal. Both of those accountings will, one assumes, may result in further judicial action. That's certainly why they're being sought by the plaintiff.
What about opposing counsel's statement, which has some support in the point that the district court called the judgment a final judgment, that the district court doesn't think there's going to be anything else? That as far as the district court's concerned, its obligation was to order an accounting. It ordered the accounting, and that's it. Now, it may be wrong about that, but the plaintiff has a right to appeal from a wrong decision about what kind of accounting is required.
The district court ordered both of the accountings that were being sought, and so the question is whether the district court may have believed there would be no further proceedings, but once the accountings are provided, it's clear from the plaintiff's brief, the plaintiff appellant's brief, that the plaintiff will be seeking relief based on those accountings, potentially some additional damages if they show that Betty Murchison is entitled to traditional funds, and that
it's clear that that's what the plaintiff wants. But is it clear that that's what the district court thinks is going to happen next? I mean, imagine we sent it back, and the district court said, well, as far as I'm concerned, the complaint asked for an accounting, and I've ordered it, and that's all I'm going to do. And even if it comes back saying more money is owed, I'm sorry, you asked for an accounting, that's all you get. Would that be a final order?
That would clearly distinguish what would happen in this case from the other cases that were cited in the 28J letter, and it would be
a final order.
If the accounting is purely providing information and it's not going to result in any judicial process, then it would be a final order, yes, Your Honor.
And how do we know that that's not what the court thought? Since I appreciate that saying something's a final appealable order doesn't make it so,
yes.
But how do we know that that's not what the district court thought was happening here?
I don't think there's any way to know that for certain, but it seems to me that district court in its decision in deciding to actually order these two accountings must have at least known that there would be likelihood, given how long this case has gone on, that the plaintiff would come into court and try to get some relief, and the court would have to rule one way or the other on those, and that would actually finally dispose of the accountings. If there are no further questions on the issue of jurisdiction.
Yeah, I have a question on the merits in the improbable event that we get to them. And that is with respect to the $800,000 claim against Betty, and this specifically your argument 1A1, Betty's waived her challenge to the district court's 2001 factual findings and legal conclusions by failing to challenge them in her prior appeal. Now, she could only appeal, of course, she may not have been even able to appeal that, but we'll pass that by. She can only appeal from a judgment, right?
Correct,
where
yeah.
Is the judgment against her for the $800,000?
The district court's August 10th, 2001 opinion.
Can we start with the? It seems to me logically it's easier to start with the judgment and see what that seems to incorporate.
The
judgment at 343 is the one that was appealed, right?
Yes, and the one at 343 refers back to the order at 310.
Right.
The 810-01 order.
Right.
And there, the court. On the bottom of 310 and the top of 311, orders that George be liable only for attorney's fees and doesn't award any damages on the plaintiff's count one and two of the plaintiff's complaint.
Right.
And then you have to refer to the...
Let's not refer. Let's see where we have an order incorporated here.
That's
have
right.
to be. Of an $800,000 judgment against Betty.
The court in 2001 did not issue any order requiring her to pay that amount,
Is there an order here finding against her in that amount?
In the judgment, Your Honor.
Hey, I'm not sure how that's different.
In the judgment, Your Honor, there is no. Ruling against her in the judgment.
So that's why we've gone to this order of August 10.
Yes.
And what is it we're going to find in the August 10 order?
In the August 10 order, there is a series of factual findings and conclusions of law that purport in the order, in the memorandum opinion, to hold John Murchison liable for...
What are the orders?
The
$800,000 liability of Betty.
If you look at...
It seemed to me this... Well, no, I'm sorry. You raised it in your brief, and you didn't have a chance to reply to their reply brief. So it's crack at it.
The district court was determining whether the amount of damages that it might award on counts one and two of Betty's complaint against George Murchison. And Betty was trying to recover for a series of transactions that, once the district court heard all of the evidence, the court realized that many of the withdrawals of funds from the ERISA plan that were improper were actually committed by John Murchison, not his brother George Murchison, the defendant. And so the district court was trying to figure out, should I award damages on counts one and two of Betty's complaint, or should I not? And the court decided not to award any damages because of the misconduct.
So Betty, on an affirmative claim by Betty, loses, right? But your claim is that she failed to appeal a judgment against her for $800,000, and that's what I'm looking for.
Well, I think in the brief, what she failed to appeal was any of the factual findings.
You don't appeal factual findings.
That well, she
you appeal judgments.
But in the sense that she was challenging she was appealing the judgment that did not award her any damages on her claim, and
okay, so I mean I can imagine a scenario under which therefore she doesn't get the damages specified in that claim. Okay, that's fine. That is rather different, I think, from having an $800,000 judgment against you awarded.
Yes, Your Honor, and the factual findings and conclusions of law in the 2001 memorandum opinion that caused the district court not to award any damages are the same factual findings and conclusions of law that go to the counterclaim that George Murchison had brought.
It is the case, then, that there is no affirmative order underlying the later judgment, an order against her with respect to the $800,000 claim against her.
The first time that happened, Your Honor, was in 2006, 2007, when after remand from this
court.
Yes,
that's what she's appealed.
That's the first time.
Yeah, yeah. So she cannot conceivably be faulted for failing to appeal from a judgment against her that didn't exist.
And
in fact, which is, it has been entered later, right, which she has appealed now.
But in 2001, when she Well, in 2001 was the first appeal. That was dismissed. But then in 2004, after the final judgment was entered by the district court and there was an appeal that was heard on the merits in this court, she did have an incentive at that time to challenge all of the factual findings in the 2001 memorandum opinion that addressed John Murchison's wrongdoing, because she was trying to get the damages that she thought she was entitled to. But instead of challenging any of those factual findings, which are the reasons why the district court did not award any damages, she claimed instead that there was a judgment against George Murchison for $115,000 at that time, and she was entitled to that regardless of what John Murchison had done and what the factual findings were. So she had an incentive to challenge all of those factual predicates in her 2004 appeal, and she didn't do that, even though the first order requiring her to pay the $800,000 only came in 2007 after remand from this court.
But as I understand it, she wasn't ordered to pay anything in 2004 on George's counterclaim, correct?
That is correct.
Okay. And George did not appeal that.
That is correct, Your Honor.
Okay, so.
So this amounts essentially to a set-off. That is, the original 2001 judgment of the district court is, well, George was bad and John was bad and John was actually badder than George, so I'm not going to order payment to George, right, or to John. We're going to sort of set it all off and nobody gets anything, right?
That's right, Your Honor. Just attorney's fees for plaintiff.
So if George thinks, well, I'm happy to stop with that, starts an appeal, but then decides, well, gee, you know, this is fine with me because this didn't order me to pay anything, so I don't need to appeal. John goes forward in the form of Betty, right?
Yes.
Saying, well, pay part of this. Pay the part that you owe. This court, looking only at that, because by that point George's appeal had dropped out, orders payment by, I want to be sure I get the names right now, payment by George, goes back to the district court, and the district court said, well, now that I understand that I have to order separate payments and I can't simply set one off against the other, the only fair thing to do is to order both of them to pay. That's your characterization of what's going on in the case.
Yes, Your Honor. I think from the outset, the district court was trying to arrive at what it thought, after hearing all of the evidence at trial, was an equitable solution. When you have a situation where essentially two trustees are in court, one trustee has brought suit against the other, and it turns out, after hearing all the evidence, that the plaintiff trustee, or at least his personal representative, the estate's personal representative, it turns out that the plaintiff trustee, if you will, was actually the far greater transgressor. What is the district court to do? It originally thought it had the power to order no damages at all.
I don't have the ERISA statute in front of me, but I have a vague recollection. It has some language about equitable determinations. Is that right or wrong?
Does
the district court have a sort of equitable jurisdiction to determine how to resolve a failure to pay into the or a prohibited transaction or not?
Well, as this court's held in the prior ruling under Section 1109, that once the district court finds that there have been losses caused to the plan, there has to be a make good order based on those losses.
Right, and your argument is that if we're going to make one make good order, we need to make two make good orders.
Well, I think the district court was trying to apply that rule to both of the parties before it based on the evidence that it had found in 2001.
Did Betty have a chance the second time to challenge that evidence, because the first time she may have not understood that it was going to impact on her?
There was no evidentiary hearing in the district court on that, Your Honor. The trial in 2001, it was certainly clear during opening statements, while the evidence was being put on, during closing arguments, that George Murchison's attorney was directly trying to put in evidence, at least for the witnesses that Betty had called, because of course George was prevented from putting on any of his own evidence. But he used the evidence that was adduced by Betty Murchison to show that the vast majority of the transactions, the improper transactions, were actually committed by John Murchison. And so it certainly was the case that Betty could have at any time during the trial challenge that evidence. She never said that evidence can't come in, and the evidence actually did come in, and then it went into the court's August 10th, 2001 memorandum opinion and became law of the case, and Betty certainly could have challenged the...
But there was no claim by George against the estate, right?
The count two of George's counterclaim, which is at page 51 of the joint appendix, is a claim against the estate, properly construed as a claim under ERISA. Both the plaintiff here, Betty Murchison, and George brought fiduciary duty claims that did not mention ERISA. The district court treated Betty's claim as a claim under ERISA. It was a common law claim for breach of fiduciary duties, count two of her complaint. And I think it's also proper to treat George's count two of George's counterclaim, which also says breach of fiduciary duties for relating to an employee benefits plan, as a claim under ERISA, even though it didn't actually mention those letters.
Okay, thank you.
Oh. Did George have counsel before this most recent appeal?
George, I believe he's not had counsel since 2003, so he didn't have counsel when the district court issued the final order in 2004, the final order that actually rendered the 2001 decision final and gave rise to the prior appeal in this case, that actually where the court reached the merits. So he didn't have counsel then when he did not appeal, and I believe he hasn't had counsel since that time.
Is there anything in the record showing why he doesn't get counsel?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. I don't know the precise reasons. I think they may be financial. I'm not sure why.
A lot of civil litigants who would like Jenner and Block to represent them.
I think you should. I mean, that's sort of very good, and you should stop at this point.
Thank you.
You don't want to debate that point, I tell you.
No. Right. I agree.
All right, Mr. Tirana.
Thank you.
Beginning with Judge Williams' last question.
You want to dispute about whether Jenner and Block's good or not?
George had excellent counsel, Chuck Smith. At the time of the trial, of the post-trial proceedings, and at the time of filing the notice of appeal, which was dismissed for lack of prosecution. He had counsel in the district court, Claude Roxborough, after the remand by this court. Claude Roxborough had been disbarred and was readmitted in the district court, but not readmitted here, so did not appear here. I want to clarify Betty's status. Betty was a beneficiary in her own right with a vested interest under the profit-sharing plan. She sued to recover what she was entitled to. She's an artist, a mother, was a housewife until her husband died in 1994, and she had a vested interest. She was suing to recover what she was entitled to, regardless of what John ever may have done.
So her interest was not by survivorship? She had a separate...
Not by survivorship.
She was an employee?
She had a vested interest, and it's not in this record, it's in the prior record, but there was a designation of beneficiary form. She was, yes, survivorship, not of a common law right or in an estate.
She's a beneficiary of John's, yeah.
But she was a survivor, survivorship under the plan itself.
Yes, right.
Her appeal was based upon the district courts in appeal number three, the district courts denying her any relief as a plan participant. Coming back to Judge Williams' questions on what happened after the remand on the accountings, and Judge Garland's also, I made motions after the final order in 2007 that the court, the district court, set deadlines for the Murchison Brothers accounting and the Central Avenue joint venture accounting. The motions were never acted on. This is some evidence that the district court intends not to do anything. Judge Wilkins asked whether there had ever been an order against Betty. I think the record is clear. There had never been an order against Betty.
Well, in your, see, your brief says that the district court made an express finding that George's counterclaim was not part of the trial. So what, you don't,
well, yeah,
don't strictly have a cite for that. That's page 5 of your reply brief.
It's footnote number 2.
2 or 315?
Let's see, in his findings. And I've cited to it in the reply brief.
The footnote says, George and Jewell have not pursued this third-party claim or counterclaim. That's what you're pointing to?
Yes. And the and the counterclaim itself is for indemnification and contribution. It's not a counterclaim against the estate of John Murchison for breaches of fiduciary duties.
No.
And furthermore, there is absolutely nothing in the pretrial order under Local Rule 16.5 that contains any claim against the estate of John Murchison, nor was there in the motion for leave to amend the pretrial statement made by George through his competent counsel, Chuck Smith, never any proposal that the pretrial statement be amended to include a claim against the estate, although George, through counsel, did ask for leave to amend to include a claim against Morris Lee. It would appear that George, through counsel, intentionally did not seek to assert a claim against the estate. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Wilkins, you were appointed by the court to represent, to be amicus for the court, and we thank you for your assistance. And Mr. Toronto, you are not appointed by the court, but we nonetheless thank you for your assistance.
But
the matter will be taken under advisement. Court is adjourned.
Stand, please. This honorable court now stands adjourned until Friday morning at 9:30.